Support for the World's Podcast comes from Curious.com, committed to helping people build their CQ, or Curious Quotient, through the game of lifelong learning. Curious, where people can learn something new every day at Curious.com/the world.
His pandering on the campaign trail today on The World. I'm Marco Werman. When candidates decide to court the Latino vote, there's very little they won't do.
Politicians come to South Florida, for example. They usually go and have a cafecito cubano to appease the Cuban vote. And sometimes they go to the West Coast and put on a sombrero and have some tacos.
Plus, 5 years after the Fukushima nuclear disaster, the cleanup continues.
You've got 20,000 workers armed with little more than garden tools who are scraping off every bit of soil within a 65-foot perimeter of every structure, every public building, playground, school, that kind of thing.
Those stories, plus putting Ma's cow back in Moscow, today on The World. Thank you for being here. As the presidential race rumbles on and heats up, here's a word you might want to be familiar with: hispandering. It came up last night at the Democratic debate hosted by Univision. Hispandering means, as you could have guessed, when a candidate says whatever Hispanics want to hear in order to win their votes. We're kicking off the show today with Maria Elena Salinas, one of Univision's primetime hosts and one of the moderators last night. She joins me from Miami. Are you detecting a lot of hispandering in this campaign? What are some of the most egregious examples you've heard?
Well, Marco, yes, we usually do have hispandering in just about every election. You see that politicians come to South Florida, for example. They usually go and have a cafecito cubano or a Cuba Libre to appease the Cuban vote. And sometimes they go to the West Coast and put on a sombrero and have some tacos. So hispandering happens all the time in all the elections. You know, sometimes we have to make sure that we call it out and that we remind candidates that they haven't always been so immigrant-friendly or so Hispanic-friendly.
Did you hear any hispandering last night in the Democratic debate between Clinton and Sanders?
Neither one of them responded to my question about some of the comments that they made in the past. For example, Hillary Clinton, in an interview in 2003, said that she was adamantly against, she called, illegal immigrants. She had already promised in the past that she would call them undocumented immigrants, not illegal immigrants. And also, Bernie Sanders did not respond to some of the comments that he made to Lou Dobbs and CNN in 2007 after voting against immigration reform, where he said he was voting against it because he didn't want millions and millions of workers coming to this country and bringing down wages and taking jobs from Americans. He went completely to the opposite way and defended his position on migrant workers and the conditions that they would be under. So, yeah, I think the hispandering did go on a bit. I don't know that it moved any votes one way or another, but I think it's clear that candidates usually say what they feel they need to say to get the Latino vote.
So I'd like to hear your quick takeaway, Maria Elena, on last night's debate, specifically the 2016 versions of Hillary and Bernie to immigration policy and reform.
Well, they go all out. They go much farther out than President Obama. They want immigration reform with a path to citizenship. They won't deport anyone. They both committed last night that they would not deport children and that they would not deport immigrants who don't have a criminal record. They say that they will have executive actions if there's no immigration reform. The problem that we have here is that they're promising so many things. And President Obama also promised immigration reform, and he made promises that he couldn't keep because it's not up to the president, it's up to Congress. And as long as you have a Republican Congress that is against immigration reform with a path to citizenship, it's just not going to happen.
Last night's debate was held in Florida, as I said, where the primary is coming up on March 15th. And Florida's a state with its own Latin identity. How would you describe it, and how does it compare with other Latino identities around the U.S.?
Well, it's a combination of so many different groups, very different one from what you see in the East Coast and the West Coast. I am from California. I was born in Los Angeles. I know that the California Latino community is very different from the Miami Latino community, for example. We have a lot more South Americans, Caribbeans here. And also politically, I think you have a mixture. Traditionally, I think that people have always seen the Cuban-American community as being very conservative. That has changed. The younger community is much more moderate, much more open. For example, on the Cuba issue, they will embrace relations with Cuba. They might embrace ending the embargo. But when it comes to Fidel Castro and what the opinion is, particularly Fidel Castro, I think they're still very strong against it.
Maria Elena Salinas, a primetime host for Univision, thank you so much. Great to speak with you.
Thank you, Marco. Likewise.
As Maria Elena mentioned, both Bernie Sanders and Hillary Clinton made a commitment last night not to deport undocumented immigrant children. Thousands of kids traveling without their parents are detained each month at the U.S.-Mexico border. Most come from Central America. Let's meet Jackie Gonzalez. She's with the Centro Legal de la Raza in Oakland, California. It's a legal aid group that handles a lot of cases involving unaccompanied minors. Gonzalez says these children face daunting legal obstacles.
Well, the largest challenge they face is needing to engage and confront a system without any appointed attorney to help them navigate the process of asylum, which is extremely complicated for an adult on their own to understand, let alone a child. Children as young as, 18 months up until they turn 18 are expected to attend court hearings on their own and engage in our immigration system to apply for asylum without an attorney.
Can you give us an example of a kid who just kind of shows how tough this issue can get?
Sure. Our office represented a young man named Edgar. Edgar was 16 years old, so older than a lot of the children that enter and could maybe better understand. But he had entered the U.S. a few months previously and understood that coming in meant that he was getting protection. And he didn't understand that he had to attend a court hearing. And because he failed to attend the court hearing, he was ordered deported in his absence. And this happens to many children who don't understand. They have multiple obligations and paperwork that they receive that they don't understand. And in Edgar's case, luckily, we were able to reopen the case and are currently seeking asylum for him. But again, his chances of winning are only based on a nonprofit legal service provider being available to assist him. And unfortunately, the demand is too great for the resources that are currently available.
I mean, I'm a citizen and an adult, and I have a hard time understanding U.S. law. We heard Clinton say last night she'd provide legal aid to these kids. And then I think about the flip side. Does the U.S. government really expect a child to build his or her own defense?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a very welcome message from both Sanders and Clinton that they want to provide an attorney or a legal aid lawyer for these children, because as you aptly point out, no child can really understand what's happening to them and certainly cannot be expected to build their own case without an attorney. So if the government is going to allow these children to enter and then place them into a procedure with the veil of due process, they certainly should be providing an attorney for them.
When one of these kids sits down with officials, what makes the difference between them staying in the U.S. and getting deported?
Well, really being able to express why they came to the United States and their fear of return. And that fear of return has to be on one of the protected grounds that asylum law recognizes. And that's the piece that becomes very difficult and complicated for a child to be able to express to a judge without the aid of counsel. Because it's a much more complex determination than simply saying this person is at risk if they are returned.
So as the presidential campaign continues, Jackie, do you think the country is making progress on coming to terms with this?
I mean, I think that the response that we heard from Sanders and Clinton yesterday was hopeful. It certainly is a very different message than Clinton was sending earlier, where she agreed with Obama and said that we had to send a message to Central America through these children. And I think that it's wrong. It's wrong to use children to send a message. These children are sending us a message. They're fleeing really violent countries where they face death, and to send them back to that country to send a message is a reprehensible and immoral thing to do.
Jackie Gonzalez is a lawyer with Centro Legal de la Raza in Oakland, California. Thank you very much for your time, Jackie.
You're welcome.
Sometimes the challenges facing immigrant kids have less to do with having the right documents and more with issues of integration. That's true for a lot of kids in Brockton, Massachusetts. It's a city with a large Cape Verdean community, and many of the kids from that community go to Brockton Public Schools, a struggling system that's managed to turn things around recently. But not for everyone, as my WGBH colleague Philip Martin reports.
At a bowling alley in this gritty city, 20-year-old Kevin Gomes, a tall, lanky man, relaxes over a soda. He's not here to knock down pins.
I just chill with my friends, be around girls, and that's it.
Being here, says Kevin, who's unemployed, means he's not on the streets of Brockton. Violent crime rates are among the highest in the state. So this bowling alley is a safe haven of sorts.
It might keep you out of trouble, unless you run into someone.
You mean like enemies?
Yeah.
Do you have enemies?
A lot of them. It's throughout the city. The city hates me, but I love my city.
Kevin Gomes' city is the third largest Cape Verdean community in the world. He's second generation. His parents, now split up, settled in Brockton, the birthplace of boxers Rocky Marciano and Marvin Hagler. A lot of people here are fighters, fighting to get by in a working-class city and fighting to stay in school.
I got kicked out for something that didn't happen in school over stupidity.
Kevin is one of hundreds of Cape Verdean youth who saw high school cut short for one reason or another. But about a year ago, he finally got his diploma.
I went to Phoenix. It's an alternative school.
That's the nickname for the school here called B.B. Russell, where kids like Kevin try to finish what they began. Street workers like Joey Gomes, not related to Kevin, helped out there.
We had an office at the school which deals with kids who are being kicked out of high school. They would come to us, and it would be for little things. Cigarette may smell like marijuana, or the kid came in late, they get demerits.
Gomes, known as Joey G., tried to understand why that was happening. Despite his efforts, though, some students turned to thug life, a life Joey G. knows well.
I was incarcerated for 17 years, 8 months, and 1 hour.
Gomes was locked up on attempted murder and bank robbery convictions. Inside, Gomes says he saw a pipeline of young men from Cape Verde to prison.
I seen a lot of brothers that came here and following the flow of whatever they see, monkey do, monkey want to do it just like you. Brothers that were trying to become westernized, but in the process of trying to be westernized, they started getting served with a 15 to 20 year mandatory.
Joey G. says school officials need to work a lot harder to find out what's going on inside Cape Verdean households before expelling kids like Kevin. Kathleen Smith agrees.
We recently have a new system that came in place because of the pipeline to prison.
Smith is superintendent of Brockton Public Schools.
You have educators that are used to a code of conduct, and some of it is zero tolerance, to now looking at mitigating circumstances.
Things like housing, joblessness, and the loss of tight-knit communities that existed back in Cape Verde. Acknowledging this came too late for Kevin Gomes, and he says he knows other young Cape Verdeans who dropped out of school and made a beeline for the streets.
I know people going in, like, today, getting locked up today. Gun charges, drug charges. Every day there's someone new, and I know them. It's a small city. You know everyone in Brockton.
And so how do you turn that around?
Good morning, Brockton Public Schools. How may I direct your call?
At Brockton School headquarters, a framed 2010 New York Times article hangs on the lobby wall. It details how Brockton High, once a failure, is now considered a model of success, outperforming 90% of Massachusetts high schools.
We have a large linguistic community made up of Cape Verdean students, and the focus is on literacy, those skills that they will need getting their high school diploma.
Yet school superintendent Kathleen Smith says dropout and expulsion rates are still too high, a problem exacerbated by structural poverty.
We have close to 600 or 700 students in our district at any time are considered homeless. Sometimes we find some of these students are working at 5 in the morning and coming to school at 7 a.m.
Smith says if she can keep addressing skills and basic needs, she can keep more students from dropping out. At the bowling alley, Kevin Gomes admits he's had close calls on the streets since leaving school. Have you been shot at?
I got shot in my car. Like, a bullet went right past my head. They could have freaking ended me, but they never did.
But his mentor, Joey G., worries about Kevin. With his diploma, they're working together to get Kevin employed and off the streets. For the World, Philip Martin, Brockton, Massachusetts.
Now to locate those 22,000 ISIS recruits. That's coming up later here on The World. I'm Marco Werman with The World. I'm going to date myself here, but a lot of the technology we're surrounded by these days once seemed like pure science fiction. Think touchscreen phones, for example. So what is the secret for coming up with inventions like that? That's what Genrik Altschuler wanted to find out. He was a science fiction writer in the Soviet Union decades ago, and he worked for a time at a patent office. Author Pagan Kennedy writes about him in her new book, Inventology, How We Dream Up Things That Change the World. She says Altschuler used his time at the patent office to answer this question.
What was the difference between the really good ideas and the really bad ideas? And he had this really new idea for, this was the 1940s, and he had the idea that if you looked through the patent system at all the patents that already existed, you could find the secret of inventing. Because here, in those thousands and thousands of patents, were the records of people finding the good ideas.
So before we get to what he came up with in terms of ideas, what was the secret he found to good ideas? What made the difference between a good idea or a good invention and a bad invention?
Well, he came up with a whole series of different systems, one of which is now known as TRIZ. And I think people, TRIZ is sort of known in the West.
It's an acronym, yeah.
It is an acronym, and I won't even begin to say, try to say it stands for something in Russian. But one of his key ideas was this idea of a contradiction. So we get in a thinking trap where we think we have to choose between choice A and choice B when we're trying to solve a problem. So an example would be batteries. You know, we want batteries to be really, really powerful, but we also want them to be really, really small. And you can't have those two things at once, or so it seems. Mm. And so people get caught in, well, do I want them to be small or do I want them to be powerful? And you begin. But now, you know, today's engineers are trying to get out of that contradiction by thinking, well, could the body of the car be part of the battery? Could the materials in the car be the battery? So kind of stepping out of that mental trap where you think it has to be A or B to looking for C or D or E, the crazy idea where you just get around that problem. So he became really fascinated with that. And he also became fascinated with the blocks that we have in creativity and what he called psychological inertia, which is, again, when you get sort of inside the box and you can't get out of it. And he became very fascinated by why that happens. And he just came up with so many really fresh ideas that I think are meaningful today.
Well, yeah, give us an example. What did Altschuler's thinking outside the box kind of lead to in terms of invention that we have in our midst today?
Well, Altschuler, writing one of his stories that I dug up from the 60s, was about a crazy inventor named Antenna who comes up with a machine that takes powder and forms it into different objects.
Hmm, interesting.
Yeah. And what I love about this story is he says this machine has to exist because the rate at which we replace technology is speeding up so fast. He pointed to TV sets. He said people are throwing away their, this is the 60s, are throwing away their black and white TV to make room for color. And soon they're going to be throwing away their color TVs to make way for their 3D TVs. And so what he was talking about was this spin of obsolescence. And so he, almost by looking at the social and political changes that were happening in his world, he was predicting where technology was going to go. And he did do it in that story, really saw the 3D printer.
His observation was spot on.
Yeah.
You know, Kurt Vonnegut Jr. once said, we need a secretary of the future to think about life in this long-term way. I mean, the Dutch look at their lowlands and think about flooding on a 200-year time horizon. Policy does need to take into account educated predictions about the future. What do you think about this idea of a secretary of the future?
I think that's a great idea. I mean, I think that also we need to not delegate our future to just a few people in power or a few very homogenous people who, you know, have a particular idea about the future. But actually, you know, what I'm going to say is going to sound really obvious, but it's not obvious. Everything that we make pretty much is for the people of the future. But it is incredibly hard to imagine the future. I would challenge listeners to just think about where you are right now and what it will look like 5 years from now. And you'll find that pretty soon your mind feels very exhausted.
I got to say, I'm not exhausted. I'm energized thinking about all of this. Hope our listeners are too. Pagan Kennedy's new book, Inventology, How We Dream Up Things That Change the World. Thanks so much for coming in.
Thank you so much.
So last week, we asked you for help finding the best new Irish punk music out there, and you really came through for us. I mean, really came through. But just a reminder, we could still use your help. We're a week away from St. Patrick's Day, and the world's Kieran Peterson has been trying to get the pulse of modern-day Irish punk. How's the hunt been going?
It's been loud, Marco.
Loud. And some of the bands people are suggesting, you like what you're hearing?
Yeah, I love what I'm hearing. A couple of standout names like Bricktop Blackguards, Kate's Party, and this band that I really like called Cutthroat Shamrock. But there's this one band that I really want to tell you about, and they're called Whiskey of the Damned.
So what are people telling you about Whiskey of the Damned?
All right, I got a quote for you. Whiskey of the Damned are the craziest, most humble set of individuals I have ever had the experience of watching and playing with. That's one of the readers that suggested it to us. They're from Wisconsin, Milwaukee, Wisconsin, and they do a lot of work to support local artists. And in fact, I liked them so much, and I liked what I was hearing so much, that I decided to catch up with Owen McCarthy, who's their fearless leader. He's originally from Dublin, but he moved to Milwaukee when he was about 13.
When we got a green card from over here, you had to declare what city you were going to stay in. They give you a list, like they give you Chicago, the Windy City, and New York, the Big Apple, and then Milwaukee was Brewtown. My dad literally pointed at Milwaukee and was like, that's where we're going. And that's how we ended up in Milwaukee.
That's awesome.
It is pretty awesome.
So he started Whiskey the Damned in 2011, and they tour all over the place. He also started this thing called Rebel Stage, which is this indie independent stage for artists of all kind at Summerfest, which is this huge music festival. And it's a pretty eccentric corner of the festival.
So listeners, Whiskey of the Damned, I hope that gets your creative juices flowing and maybe some more ideas about other Irish punk bands. Kieran, you want more submissions? How can our listeners send you names?
All right, you guys are going to go, what I said last week, you're going to go to pritheworld.tumblr.com. I'm going to have a post up there. You can fill out a forum, tell me some stuff about them, and you have until the end of the day today. And I'm actually going to play you guys out with Owen's recommendation of band. They're called the Toss Pints, and the song is called Whiskey Be My Savior. Life is
now just me. That was the world's Kieran Peterson. News headlines are just around the corner, and then in a bit, the Pakistani lawyers who enforce the country's blasphemy laws here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. They say there's no cow in Moscow unless it's not the Russian capital, but a small town in Tennessee.
That Ma's cow was one of the folk tales that people would tell as to why a place was named Moscow.
America's many Moscows ahead on The World.
The World is brought to you by Public Radio International with support from TIAA CREF, a global financial company that's created to serve and built to perform. You can learn more at TIAA.org.
I'm Marco Werman, and this is The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH here in Boston. A thumb drive that had been in the Mideast turns out to be a data haul with deep implications in the fight against a so-called Islamic State. A massive list with names, addresses, and even phone numbers for some 22,000 ISIS recruits from all over the globe. An ISIS defector reportedly handed the information to news outlets in Germany and Britain. Will Geddes is a security expert in Britain, and I asked him, how do we know these documents are real?
Well, at the moment, we don't, and security services and various agencies are going to be very, very hesitant to obviously make any particular statements at this stage until obviously they can verify their authenticity. However, having said that, inevitably they're going to want to get a head start if these documents do prove to be true, because some of the identifiers, particularly on these documents, are going to be essential in terms of not only naming specific individuals, but also naming some of their referrers or recruiters. And one of the things that's been the consistent challenge has been in trying to dismantle and interrupt the radicalization process. So the naming of key individuals in certain territories that are probably instrumental to finding those sympathetic to IS and helping facilitate their access into either Iraq and Syria or even to potentially undertaking attacks. The security services are going to want that head start to be able to intercept these individuals, gather obviously any forensic intelligence around their communications and assess and evaluate it to even potentially stop any attacks taking place.
The evaluation process must be really tricky. I mean, ever since November's attacks in Paris, a big question officials have is when and where will ISIS-inspired militants try and strike next? How will this data actually help in that?
Well, I don't think it's necessarily going to tell us exactly where the next possible attack will take place. But what it will do is potentially show and illustrate what players are in which particular regions and which particular countries. Now, amassing that with intelligence that they already have could very well create a clearer picture as to the capabilities and resources, and more particularly the personnel in that area that may be potentially aiming to undertake those types of attacks. Because it's understood that certainly within one of the fields of these documents, there are even a section for those that are willing to undertake martyrdom or suicide attacks. Now, again, those that have identified themselves willing to undertake that will be very, very important and obviously critical for the agencies to be able to then identify those people quickly.
Can you tell us how these documents made their way out of ISIS hands, if they are in fact real, and into the hands of German and British media? What do we know?
What we know at the moment is it's believed to be a former member of the Free Syrian Army Brigade, who originally was recruited by al-Nusra Front, subsequently then migrated over into Islamic State. This individual supposedly has become disenchanted with Daesh's agenda and particularly their methodologies right now, and has decided to defect. Now, in terms of the access to this information, it's believed that he had access to Daesh's equivalent of, if you like, the internal police. And he had access, obviously, to hard drives by which he was then able to insert a thumb drive, be able to copy and remove that information and obviously take it away with him.
Daesh being the Arabic name for ISIS. Do we know if the Germans are going to share these documents with the US or other intelligence services?
Well, I think it's highly likely that because it's a German and UK media companies that managed to actually recruit this source and obtain, obviously, this data, that the various government agencies will have pounced on, obviously, those media agencies in the nicest possible way and obviously wanted to get copies of this and no doubt will, to a certain extent, try and influence reporting in a responsible way to ensure that any information that could influence ongoing or current operations won't be compromised. Inevitably, because there is a good join-up these days, and increasingly so between various multinational agencies and international agencies, that there's a very good chance that duplications of this data will be provided to our counterparts in Canada, in the United States, and into various other agencies around the world.
Will Geddes is the founder of Corporate Security Services in the UK. Thank you for speaking with us today, Will.
Thank you, sir.
In Pakistan, defiling the name of the Prophet Muhammad could cost you your life. The official penalty for blasphemy is a death sentence, and that's assuming the suspect in a case is not lynched or murdered before the trial. My BBC colleague Mobeen Ajar has been looking into a group of Pakistani lawyers who aggressively promote and prosecute blasphemy cases. Ajar says it's astonishingly easy to be charged with blasphemy in Pakistan.
Quite often these things can actually stem from domestic disputes. You might have, for example, a Muslim family and a Christian family. Their children get into a relationship, and all of a sudden, there's the accusation that the Christian family have burnt or defiled the Quran or insulted the Prophet Muhammad. Now, as you can imagine, that results in a whole heap of fallout. So the community will gather around a particular house. The default position seems to be to arrest people and charge them and ask questions later.
So along comes this group of highly educated lawyers, not the kind of people I'd expect to be kind of championing these blasphemy laws. Who are these guys?
This is a group of lawyers led by someone called Ghulam Mustafa Chowdhury. Now, this group, made up of about 700 lawyers in the Punjab, have made it their business, really, to prosecute people who are charged with blasphemy. And they often do this without charging a fee. So they are the go-to people. So if you want to charge someone with blasphemy, if you feel that you have a case, you can call Ghulam Mustafa Chowdhury and you can take people to court.
So when one of these cases is taken to court by this movement, what's it look like in the courtroom?
I would describe it as a mob mentality. So you'll often see courtrooms which are packed with people who want to see a prosecution. It can be very loud and boisterous, and they'll pack the room with clerics and with people who really want a conviction. It's a bit like theater, really. So you'll hear jeering and you'll hear threats whispered.
Yeah, I was going to say, does the force of numbers just kind of move the judge to have come up with certain verdicts that are almost inevitable?
I would argue that it does. And also, I think people get very, very emotional. So rather than just looking at the facts of a case, again and again, you'll hear lawyers saying this is about the honor of the prophet or honoring Islam or preserving Islamic identity in Pakistan. And that's a real problem, because when you look at the facts of the case, often there is no real evidence. But when you're faced with these kind of grandiose statements about honoring the prophet, it's going to be very difficult to actually have a verdict based on evidence.
So somebody like Ghulam Mustafa Chowdhury, how does he respond to his critics?
Ghulam Mustafa Chowdhury is a really strange character. I remember meeting him maybe 18 months ago in his office, and you walk in and he's quite presidential in the way he presents himself. You can imagine him in this quite plush office with a leather chair. He's always got a cigar in his hand. And he's very polite, so he'll offer you tea and biscuits, and then you get down to business. He said to me, he said, there is only one punishment for blasphemy, and there's only one punishment for insulting the Prophet Muhammad, and that is death. There is no alternative. It's my duty to defend the honor of the Prophet Muhammad, and I'll do that using the law. And he sees it as something that he will be rewarded for on the Day of Judgment. And that's what he told me.
Is there any chance that there will be reform to these blasphemy laws?
I think it will take a very brave set of people to move forward and even get that discussion really going. And I think those people at the moment, there isn't a critical mass in terms of people raising their head above the parapet. It's just not happening at the moment.
Mobeen Azhar, my BBC colleague, thanks so much.
Thank you.
For our next story, I have Nina Porzuki here in the studio. She's one half of our language podcast, The World in Words.
Have you ever wondered about the story behind the name of a place? Like, for example, I grew up on Linda Drive. Who the heck was Linda? Or why is Berlin, New Hampshire, pronounced Berlin and not Berlin?
Yeah, like I've got so many questions myself.
What?
There was a village in upstate New York, not far from where I live, called Swastika. Like, what's up with that? Or in Burkina Faso, the village of Rambo, and just down the road, Rambo 2. I don't think they saw First Blood. And then in North Carolina, Lizard Lick. I never found out what was the origin of that name. Anyway, yeah.
Good.
Always.
Well, these are all good questions. And The World in Words is starting this occasional series that we're calling Name Tag. And we're going to be digging into stories behind some of these kinds of questions. And to kick things off, here's a little taste of a story from Alina Simone. She's our expert on all things quirky and all things Russian. And she was curious about why so many towns across the U.S. are named Moscow. Like, how did they get those names and why are they still named Moscow even after the Cold War? There are actually 26 Moscows in the U.S.
26? That's incredible.
26. And she found a professor who researched the origins of these towns. So here's just a little taste of what Alina found out about these 26 Moscows.
When Ren Vasiliev, now a professor of geography at the State University of New York Geneseo, was a graduate student, she decided to tackle the riddle of America's many Moscows. It was 1986, and in those misty pre-internet days, a project like this required a lot of analog legwork.
I wrote to their historical societies.
She pored through old county history books, but most of these Moscows didn't have much to do with the Russian capital. They weren't even pronounced Moscow.
No, some of them were Moscow, The ones in the South would have had a Southern drawl, which it would have been the Moscow kind of thing. And that Moscow was one of the folk tales that people would tell as to why a place was named Moscow.
Ren's story was confirmed when I called up an actual resident of Moscow. Indiana, that is.
This is Jack Baldwin, can I help you?
Jack was born and raised in Moscow and was always curious about his town's name.
And I would ask all the old folks there in town if anybody knew how the town got its name. Well, I got all these folky answers like, well, it's because of the moss in the river and they used to send the cows down there to graze on the moss. Moscow. And then Moscow, like belonging to your mother's. Yeah. And just, you know, nobody really had any idea where the name came about.
But despite what locals believed, Moscow, Indiana, in fact, no Moscow in the United States, was ever named after Ma's lost cow. That didn't mean these places didn't get their names from unlikely sources, like Napoleon.
Oh, Napoleon. The fact that the regular people, the peasants in Moscow and surrounding areas beat the living daylights out of this world leader and his army, that was really impressive over here, because here we are, you know, this upstart country, and that was really great news. And so a lot of new places named themselves after Napoleon's defeat.
But most Moscows weren't named for anything remotely connected to Russia. Tennessee's Moscow was an anglicized version of a Native American word meaning between two rivers. Other Moscows were the result of a misunderstanding, like the case of Moscow, Kansas, which tried to name itself after Luis de Moscoso, a Spanish conquistador. They decided to shorten the name to M-O-S-C-O, but when they submitted an application to create a post office,
it had W at the end of it. Because the guy in D.C. thought that these little, you know, silly people in Kansas didn't know what they were doing and had spelt the name wrong. So he had added that W on it.
But the biggest reason to name your community Moscow, she learned, was for a simple bureaucratic reason. All the obvious names were taken.
Things like Spring Valley or Springfield or Blossom Hill or, you know, those kinds of really pretty generic names were already taken. And so people started using what were considered exotic names, hoping that no one had already used them.
Yes, there was one lonely Moscow, Moscow, Pennsylvania, that was allegedly named by actual Russian people. What's the story there?
There was a guy. There's always a guy. Okay, here. Lackawanna County, Pennsylvania. There was a guy named Reverend Rupert who came to the site back in 1830. And it was said that Moscow was named for Moscow, Russia, by early settlers, possibly Russian-German Lutherans.
Only one Moscow, the town now called Leicester in New York, cast the name aside after the communists came into power. But the rest of the Moscows not only kept their names, they celebrated them. Back in 1980, the town of Moscow, Kansas, population 228, even offered to host the Olympics when the U.S. boycotted the games being held in Russia that year. Politicos in Washington, D.C. may not always be happy to hear the word Moscow, but for the many Muscovites of the USA, like Jack Spalding in Moscow, Indiana, it just sounds like, well, home.
I'll tell you what, it's just a great place. Moscow was always my town, you know.
For the world, this is Alina Simone.
So that's just a little taste of what Alina found. Mm. She actually ended up speaking to a man from Kazakhstan who went on a quest to all 26 of the Moscows. He thinks that there's some sort of like mystical Russian-American connection and he's going to find it in these places. You can hear that more on the podcast.
Wow. He's an obsessive man, or are there more trust fund babies in Kazakhstan than we knew?
Who knows?
How can people submit their own name tag questions, Nina?
So that's easy. They can email us, language@pri.org, and just put name tag in the subject line. Or people can even tweet questions at us. We're at Lingopod. We may just pick some of the questions to report them for air.
at LingoPod. That's the one on Twitter if you want to tweet your suggestions. Nina Porzucchi, one half of The World in Words, our podcast about languages and the people who speak them. And you can subscribe to The World in Words on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. Nina, thanks so much.
Thanks so much, Marco.
I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. It's hard to believe, but tomorrow is the 5th anniversary of the Great East Japan Earthquake, as it's known there. It's a dramatic title, but it was a dramatic event. An earthquake which triggered a massive tsunami which killed nearly 16,000 people. Those two events also led to the worst nuclear disaster since Chernobyl at the Fukushima Daiichi nuclear power plant. Journalist Steve Featherstone toured the power plant and surrounding towns last fall to report on the cleanup for Popular Science. The nuclear plant is being decommissioned, but after a meltdown, Steve, as you know, you can't just shut the door. It's a long process. It's decommissioning business. What does it look like inside right now?
Now, the plant itself, when they bring you in, they give you sort of a bird's eye view from a taller building because the whole site is kind of set on a bluff overlooking the Pacific Ocean. From that position up above, the most striking thing is the enormous amount of water tanks that are now on site. There's a thousand of them now where there might have just been a handful before.
And what's the point of those water tanks?
They are holding all the contaminated water that is being poured on the reactors to keep the melted fuel that's slumped to the bottom of them cool. Now, the problem today, if we're looking at the most immediate problem in the near term, is this water, because it can't all be captured. There is a natural flow of water, hundreds of tons of water, that flow underneath the site, and it gets contaminated from the nuclear material that's in the ground. And it's not all being captured, and some of it is ending up in the ocean.
How many years is it going to take before that radioactive material at the bottom of those tanks is completely cooled down and can be disposed of?
It'll be hot for years, and they'll have to keep cooling it for years. It'll take decades to actually pull it out.
Let's talk about the surrounding towns and villages. I remember in 2011 going to one town called Itate that was not in the exclusion zone, but it had really high radiation levels nonetheless, so it was completely evacuated, and officials were literally shaving a foot of dirt off the topsoil and bagging it. Is the cleanup effort in the exclusion zone still underway, and is the goal eventually to have all the evacuees move back?
Yes, it is. In fact, in the mandatory evacuation zone, you've got 20,000 workers armed with little more than garden tools, shovels, rakes, clippers, hedge trimmers, pressure washers, who are, as you said, sort of digging down, I believe it's 2 inches, and scraping off every bit of soil within a 65-foot perimeter of every public building, playground, school, that kind of thing.
Wow.
All that dirt, yeah, I know, it's a lot of dirt.
Is that going to work?
Stuff. Well, I was in Naraha, which is the first town to reopen since the disaster. It opened last September. At that time, only maybe 150 people had chosen to move back from temporary housing. Radiation levels in town were at the level set by the government, which is 1 millisievert per year. So it worked if you're in the main areas of town. If you go outside of these main areas, those weren't touched. So the contamination levels, you know, the mountains are still probably, you know, 500, 600 times the levels they are in town in the radiation. I mean, I went into the mountains myself, yeah, and they're still quite radioactive.
So you've got these people with trowels and rakes and shovels cleaning things up. What do we know 5 years on about the health impacts for the general population in that region, aside from the cleanup workers?
That's a really tricky question because there is a health risk. All international guidelines about radiation exposure to civilians says that there is no such thing as a safe dose of radiation. Now, that does not mean that any dose will harm you. What we do know is that levels below 100 millisieverts, which is quite a bit, because a moment ago I was talking about 1 millisievert is what the Japanese government has set for exposure to civilians, 1 millisievert per year. For levels that are below 100 millisieverts, we don't know a lot. We simply just don't know. We do know that there is a risk. We can't say what that risk is. However, if you compare that to the risk of leaving your home, living in temporary housing, the stress that's associated with that, there have been studies out there that show that that has been much more damaging to people's health than what 1 millisievert of radiation would do.
How many people were displaced back in 2011, and how many people are still away from their old homes?
Approximately 167,000 people fled during the disaster. Today, there's roughly 100,000 people who have not gone home, and maybe 80,000 of them are people who cannot go home because their towns are restricted. They can't move back in yet.
So there are the ones who can't go back home, and then there are the former residents you've reported on who don't want to go back. Why not?
Well, it's a really complicated thing. Before I left and when I got to Japan, immediately I was asking everybody about radiation. Are you scared about radiation? You don't want to move back because of the radiation, right? Mm. And I would get these sort of cockeyed responses like, well, no, I mean, radiation's part of it. Or the complete opposite. No, I don't think about radiation at all. What I received in reply was a much more complicated answer. And that was, well, I would go back if my son would come with me. Or I would move back if there was a school open. So it's really much, much more complicated than whether or not a certain level of radiation decontamination has been achieved. I think for the most part, people who have fears over radiation exposure, whether or not those fears are founded in science or the medical literature, whether or not that's true, those people are never going to move back, period. The things that I think are keeping most people I spoke to away were the social reasons.
So Japan has just two nuclear reactors operating at the moment. That's because yesterday a local court ordered the only other two in the country to be turned off. The Japanese government says the country needs to bring back the power plants that were shut down after the disaster, but there's a lot of local pushback. What is the general attitude about nuclear power among Japanese people, especially those in this northeast part of the country?
Well, that's a great question because there is a concept called the nuclear village that was present in Japan since the 50s. The government gave lavish subsidies and the nuclear industry gave lavish tax compensation to these local communities to host these plants. They basically just agreed, a gentleman's agreement, not to mess with each other. So you had a sort of myth in place, this myth of 100% absolute safety. And I think what happened post-Fukushima is now you've got the pendulum has swung in the complete other direction. Now nobody trusts anything the government says about radiation, and to say nothing about what the nuclear industry says about radiation.
Did you get any sense when you were in Japan of how long it's going to take for the Fukushima region to get back to normal, if it ever will?
It won't ever be normal. If we just talk strictly about the physical nature of the place, it will be contaminated for many, many generations. People will move back, but not as many. There's been an exodus of young people who won't come back. So now you've got sort of broken families. So the social impact there, I think, has been much greater than the sort of the physical impact because, you know, the radiation will decay, but all the broken families, all the broken social bonds, the broken communities, those will take a long, long time to recover.
Steve Featherstone is a science journalist who reported on the Fukushima cleanup for Popular Science. Steve, thanks for talking to us.
Thank you, Marco.
And that will do it for us today. From the Nan and Bill Harris studios here at WGBH in Boston, I'm Marco Werman. We'll catch you back here tomorrow.
PRI, Public Radio International.